This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks everybody for being here with us today. This is Rick Moore on WNRN and the Sunday morning wake-up call. It's also 91.9 and Cruze and the Valley's 101.1. So thanks for being here. It is a nice Sunday out there. Got up this morning. A little chilly on the toes, but otherwise beautiful outside. Our conversation today with Bob Gibson. He's the executive director at the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. It's always a pleasure to join you, especially after such a good music show.
I know the bluegrass. Rusty's like, oh, I might go on a minute early. I'm like, you could play a whole other song in bluegrass for a minute. But he recognizes the fact that Bob Gibson doesn't get here often enough, so let's take advantage of the few extra seconds. We are going to be talking about politics. That shouldn't be a surprise with the director at the Institute for Political Leadership. But a little different than you've seen the rest of the week. We're going to talk about more than just who won and why they won and what the percentages were. But we're going to talk about redistricting and gerrymandering. And we're going to talk about one of my key parts of the conversation for today is how is it that the same states that vote for conservative leadership vote to legalize marijuana or have for a minimum wage increase or issues of that sort, more liberal issues awarded at the same time that more conservative leaders will be taking over. So lots going on today. Again, Bob Gibson, he's the executive director at the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership here in Charlottesville. So Bob, let's jump into it. One of the first questions that I want to talk about is the issue about incumbency and re-election. Before you go into the election for months and even several years now, the approval rating for Congress is atrocious. In fact, that was part of the joke was no matter how bad people dislike President Obama, they dislike Congress even more. And yet then you had, I believe the figure you gave me was 86% of House members and senators were reelected.
A little bit more than that. 87% were reelected, and there's an 87% disapproval rating of Congress. So how does that happen? Well, one way it happens is that incumbents, people who are already in office, have a tremendous money advantage in fundraising over people who challenge them because the people who fund campaigns often give only to incumbents. If they're a special interest group, they like to have incumbents, office holders on their side, so they fund them whether they're Democrats or whether they're Republicans. They fund the incumbents, and the incumbents have a tremendous money advantage, and it takes more and more money to run for elective office in this country, be it at the national level, the state level, even now at the local level. And the other reason, the other big reason that we keep seeing 87% or more of our officials reelected is gerrymandering. We have a system in this country where, in many places, including Virginia, especially Virginia, Virginia is one of the most gerrymandered states in the nation, we have our officials picking their voters rather than our voters picking our officials. They set district lines so that they are very safe Republican districts and very safe Democratic districts, and it's very hard for someone of the opposite party to field a competitive candidate and run a competitive race in a gerrymandered district.
Well, let's talk about money first. Again, Bob Gibson here, executive director at the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. If you are so unhappy with the candidate who's in office, why does money matter in terms of that person being reelected?
Because you've got to have a choice to change officials. You've got to have a choice. And our system is gerrymandered so that there are not that many choices. Look at the 11 congressional districts we had across Virginia in Tuesday's election. All 11 are landslides. Three Democrats won landslide victories, including One who'd never run before, Don Beyer, who won the 8th District seat, replacing Jim Moran in Northern Virginia in the 8th Congressional District in Arlington and Fairfax and Alexandria and Falls Church. And we had 8 Republican congressmen, all reelected, with the exception of a new Republican who was elected in a Republican district to replace Frank Wolf, Barbara Comstock, a Republican, former delegate. Currently, she is a delegate. She'll be a former delegate very soon when she joins the Congress. And she represents Frank Wolf's 10th district in Northern Virginia, which stretches from Fairfax County out to the Shenandoah Valley.
But if you, and I realize I'm being naive, comes naturally, is that if the name that you that has all the money is associated with unhappiness, why does that person get reelected?
Well, the individual isn't necessarily associated with unhappiness. Look at Mark Warner, who won a narrow re-election victory on Tuesday. Mark Warner was in the exit polls and in the polls leading up to the election viewed favorably by 54-56% of the electorate. So while they don't like Congress, and that's very clear, they did like their senator. And yet he didn't get 54 or 56% of the vote. He got 49% and won with that, in a race that was very, very tight until the very end. It tightened at the end.
So this goes back to a phrase that I've often used, which is, "I don't like the group, but my guy, he's good."
Well, there's still some truth to that. I think that used to be more true. I think incumbents' favorable records. Ratings are lower today than they have been in recent years, but that doesn't mean that they're as vulnerable as you might think, because they have safe 90% of them have safe seats, safe districts. They can't be beaten except by their own party, as Eric Cantor was in the 7th Congressional District in June, when on the June 10th primary, Republicans out of nowhere surprised the number 2 ranking Republican in the House of Representatives by soundly defeating him in a Republican primary with a more conservative Republican, Dave Bratt, who sort of campaigned against Eric Cantor from the right.
We are talking politics today, trying to do a little bit different than just tell you who won and what the percentage points were. Bob Gibson here today from the Sorenson Institute of Political Leadership. You can find their website, Sorenson, S-O-R-E-N-S-E-N, Institute, .org. Lots of really cool articles on that website. It is 8 after the hour, talking about post-election politics. So we chatted about money briefly, but I'm curious. We as a country, we don't seem to be doing much about removing money from the race.
Well, part of that is the U.S. Supreme Court, which has decided that money is equivalent to speech, and that you can't regulate speech, therefore you can't regulate money. That's basically the argument that the majority in the Supreme Court has held. So that has struck down the limits that have been placed, many of the limits that have been placed on campaign contributions. Virginia has a long history of no limits on campaign contributions. You can give any official any amount of money in any election as long as you report it. And that's changing as well, because the Supreme Court several years ago in the Citizens United case ruled that corporate and super PAC donations can come in, and they can come in not necessarily as accountably as other donations. In other words, dark money is coming into the system, flowing in larger and larger amounts now from sources that don't disclose the donor.
But money has been, it's I want to say it's easy. I'm in agreement that that the Citizens United case at the Supreme Court made money more prevalent. But we can go back long before that to find that candidates with lots of money, that's one of the reasons that many people say Mark Warner was first elected, is because he had a lot of money.
Well, when he first ran, he ran an Ed Gillespie race. He ran against John Warner, the sitting U.S. Senator back in 1996, and John Warner beat him rather handily, but Mark Warner did well enough in that race that when he ran a second time for governor of Virginia, back in 2001, he won. So Mark Warner lost the first time around, but did well enough self-funding. He spent millions of his own dollars so that when he ran for governor, he beat the Republican Mark Early, a Virginia state senator from Chesapeake.
Do you think that the United States will ever change its thoughts on money in political elections, or is that all part of our be successful, you know, earn your money and you can do what you like with it?
Well, the Supreme Court has left the door open for money to be more transparent. They, in the Citizens United case, didn't say you had to have secret dark money coming in, but they left it up to the Congress. And the Congress has been so dysfunctional since that U.S. Supreme Court decision that the Congress hasn't found a way to make that donations of money have to have names attached to them. So you can really blame the Congress, the dysfunctional Congress, for the fact that money is flowing in dark and secret amounts, secret sources, rather. And I think as long as this current U.S. Supreme Court is setting the law of the land and determining how campaign money must flow, striking down some congressional regulation, it looks like big money is going to be... There's no immediate claim that big money is going to disappear.
It's 12 after the hour. We'll give out the phone number. Anybody wants to call with a question or a comment, we will be gladly take your call and put you on air. 434-979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Bob Gibson here. He's the executive director at the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership. Starting off by talking about incumbency and being reelected. Bob, you said 87% of U.S. citizens gave thumbs down to Congress, yet 87% of the candidates up for reelection won.
That's a pretty good disconnect, isn't it?
Yeah. And it seems like I'm having trouble putting that into my head, except to say, well, because you can get more personal service from your House representative or possibly even from your senator, that you can give them a thumbs up because they know they did something for you or for your neighbor, or you heard some sort of Kevin Bacon within the six steps tale about a good deed that your representative did, that you can revote them.
Well, that used to matter more, I believe. I think constituent service records helped elect incumbents more than they do now, because a lot of these congressional elections have become nationalized. It matters what letter you carry after your name, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And this particular election this year, if you were running in the midterms, you were disadvantaged in some cases greatly by carrying the letter D after your name, and you were advantaged by carrying the letter R after your name. And it didn't matter as much whether you were doing good constituent service work, because voters were sending a message to Washington. They were sending a message about some of their disapproval of the president, for example, who carries a 42% approval rating. Now, that is much higher than Congress, but look at how the campaign was waged by the Democrats and the Republicans. The Republicans tied every Democrat they could to Barack Obama. Ed Gillespie went around and most of his commercials said, you know, 97% of the time Mark Warner votes with President Obama. The Democrats weren't exactly embracing Obama. They were sort of running away from Obama. And there was no one defending the economic policies of the Democrats, which may have been popular, but weren't getting any sort of defense in the campaigns.
We were talking about, briefly touched on gerrymandering. I believe that this will come up throughout the conversation for the hour. Are you a member of this new committee, the Governor's Commission to Ensure Integrity and Public Confidence in State Government, or just a healthy participant?
No, I did attend their public hearing Thursday night at the UVA Law School. They held a public hearing on what sort of ethics reforms and redistricting reforms might be proposed for the next session of the General Assembly in January. This is a commission that was recently appointed by Governor Terry McAuliffe, and he named 10 individuals, 5 of them aligned with the Republicans and 5 of them aligned with the Democrats. And they have co-chairs. Rick Boucher, a former Democratic congressman from 9th District, Southwest Virginia, is a co-chair, and he chaired Thursday evening's hearing at the UVA Law School, public hearing. And Bill Bowling, former Lieutenant Governor of Virginia and a Republican, is the other co-chair. So there are a lot of people in Virginia who are following what kind of ethics reforms this group might propose for the General Assembly, but they got an earful Thursday night at UVA from about 40 people who came and were strong supporters of redistricting reform, trying to take the partisanship and the gerrymandering out of redistricting.
The committee itself has many tasks in front of it, from ethics reform to other things. We'll talk about ethics. I have David Toscano coming on in early December, and I'm sure that we will talk about ethics at that point. But let's stick to the gerrymandering and the redistricting issue that the commission is invited to ensure integrity for. Why would the party in power want to redistrict in any way?
Well, the party in power has to redistrict after each census in 10-year increments.
But that doesn't mean that they can't politely fudge the system so that it continues to keep them in power.
Well, they do. I mean, the art of redistricting, gerrymandering, has become so strong, the electronic knife is so powerful, that they can go down streets and take Republicans on one side of the street and put them in their district, and Democrats on the other side of the street and put them in a different district in some cases, and, you know, target whether or not an individual candidate for public office, this is often done, is going to be in a certain district or not. And it really does amount in many cases to lawmakers choosing their voters rather than voters in an election choosing their officials, because the districts are so skewed to one party or the other after this process that it's very hard to get competition in November in a fair race.
But one of the topics that has come up to help prevent this, by the way, first of all, is gerrymandering illegal or just a negative term for the most part?
It is both illegal if it's too extreme, and it's a negative term. It has been with our republic since the beginning. When James Madison ran for the 5th district seat in the House of Representatives back in the first election for that seat, Patrick Henry was governor and tried to steer the lines to defeat his friend, who's not really his friend, James Madison. Madison won anyway, despite being, in effect, gerrymandered in that election. The term was coined when Governor Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts created a district that looked like a salamander around Boston. And Gerry later became a very powerful politician. In addition to being governor of Massachusetts, he was a vice president of the United States. But his name has forever stuck to that gerrymandered district, and now the process of gerrymandering, which creates a partisan advantage for one side and tends to limit competition in the November election.
But is it, I believe we all know or can easily guess that it's, that racial gerrymandering is illegal.
It can
be. In fact, Virginia was pointed out to have several.
Virginia has one district, the 3rd Congressional District, represented by Bobby Scott, a longtime congressman and former state senator from Newport News, whose district snakes along and crosses over the James River from Norfolk and Portsmouth to Newport News, where Bobby Scott lives, back over to the south side of the James and creeps up into across the James again into Richmond. And it's sort of a long, skinny district that a federal court has recently ruled was packed by the last redistricting. The black voters in the district, the majority-minority district, were increased unconstitutionally during that redistricting. So the federal courts have ordered the General Assembly of Virginia to redistrict that district. And to do that, they're going to have to take voters out of that district and put them in three or four, perhaps, other districts nearby. It may eventually have some ripple effect up here, but right now it looks like it will mostly affect the 2nd District in Norfolk and Virginia Beach, the 4th District, which is south of the James, and the 7th District, which is now being represented by Dave Bratt.
20 minutes after the hour, Bob Gibson here from the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership. 979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Be right back.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Showalter's Orchard and Old Hill Cider, family-owned orchard in Timberville. The orchard and tasting room are open for pick-your-own apples and tastings of Old Hill's five styles of cider. At showaltersorchard.com, you can learn more about the orchard and where you can find Old Hill Cider.
Fardowners, local beer, local food, local music, and local vibe at the Square in Crozet. Fardowners serves local and organic meats, breads, and beers, has nightly dinner specials, Sunday brunch, live music every weekend, and can cater your next event. Find the menu and music schedule at fardowners.com.
The Frontier Culture Museum, currently celebrating 26 years of bringing the past to life through historical interpretation of how the American frontier was formed. The Frontier Culture Museum is located at the intersection of I-81 and I-64 in Staunton, Virginia. Information at frontiermuseum.org.
You can donate your unwanted vehicle to help fuel independent music radio WNRN. All you need is the title, and we'll take care of the rest. Your car can be worth more than a dealer will give you, and your tax-deductible donation supports your radio station. To learn how your car, boat, motorcycle, or RV can help WNRN, go to WNRN.org and the vehicle donation link.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today as we sort of talk about all kinds of politics, not just the numbers from the recent election. Bob Gibson here, Executive Director at the Sorenson Institute. Bob, we were talking about gerrymandering there. So we know that setting up a district based on race is illegal. But is it illegal to do so based on party? Because not all African Americans are Democrats,
all whites. That's so true, and it's not really illegal based on race. It is illegal to overdo it based on race. It is perfectly legal, according to the Voting Rights Act, to maintain majority-minority districts. So the legislature has a tightrope to walk as they consider how to redraw a majority-minority district, such as the 3rd District. They can maintain a majority of black voters in that district and be perfectly legal according to the Supreme Court and the guidelines of the federal courts. Or they can pack the district with more Democrats, more minority voters, and cross the line into an unconstitutional redrawing, which is apparently what they did according to the federal court's most recent ruling. So the U.S. Supreme Court has given wide latitude to legislatures to continue to use partisanship as a major factor, and it has become the major factor in redistricting.
Which takes me back to a question from a few minutes ago, is why would the group in power, even though you're forced to redistrict after every census, why would you set it up so that there's actually competitive races? Because that seems to be what one of the purposes of Governor McAuliffe's commission is meant to do, is to try and make things so that the, and I don't have your phrase down word for word, so that the voters elect the candidates, not the candidates electing the voters.
Right, and that's a very important principle, and it's one that the legislature has refused year after year to adopt. The legislature, the General Assembly in Virginia, and the state legislatures in many other states, like to keep that power to themselves, and they like to exercise it in a partisan fashion when they can. So we are faced with a situation where the legislature wants one thing. Polls show 74-75% of Virginians want something else, and yet they don't feel passionately enough about it or understand it fully enough and make it a top priority for them that they are going to change yet what the General Assembly does. So if the General Assembly is left to its own devices, it's going to continue to gerrymander.
Do you think it's going to go to court? Or the court is going to say, look, you need to do this.
It's in court. And
not just for that one district.
Likely to stay in court.
I mean for the state.
There's a possibility, although I think this is really arguing for a political fix, which would probably take a constitutional amendment to the state constitution. Dick Howard, who drew that constitution in 1971, the UVA law professor, calls this the most important voting rights, civil rights issue of our time, which is fixing the gerrymandering that has taken competitiveness out of our elections.
And here we are 43 years later, still waiting for that constitutional amendment or something similar to be passed.
It's not an easy task. Every year the General Assembly considers a number of bills. Usually they pass in the Virginia Senate with a broad bipartisan base of support, knowing that they're going to be killed in a House committee, and they go over to the House of Delegates, where a subcommittee meeting at 7 o'clock, typically on a Monday morning, will say, we will now consider that bill. It's dead.
And constitutional amendments have to be passed twice before they even get, I mean, have to be fully passed.
In the same form.
Two years in a row.
Not even a word or a comma change.
Right.
2 years with an intervening election for the Virginia General Assembly in between. So two different Virginia General Assembly sessions have to pass the constitutional amendment, then it goes to the voters. That's why there's a group that Lee Middleditch and others, Bill Bowling is part of this group, called One Virginia 2021 Virginians for Fair Redistricting has formed. And this group has a 7-year mission to make sure that the constitutional amendment passes in time for the next redistricting in 2021. It's a difficult task. It is an uphill battle. And it needs the kind of citizen support, the kind of grassroots effort that it apparently is starting to gain.
You mentioned that you say that Virginia is one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. What makes you say that?
People who have looked at our elections and the lack of competition in our congressional elections and the fact that our state general assembly elections are about 85-90% uncontested or not competitively contested. There are only about 10 or 12 elections for the General Assembly that are in districts that are close in November. The rest of them, if you're an incumbent, you're more likely to be challenged by your party in June for the nomination than you are in November by the other party, because the other party doesn't stand a chance in your district. So you are more attuned to your party's base and fear a challenge from someone to the left or to the right in the base of your party more than you fear the other party in November. That gives us people who are more listening to the base of their party than they are to the broad majority of voters.
Eric Cantor and Dave Bratt being the example.
Well, Dave Bratt came out of nowhere and did a masterful job of defeating Eric Cantor and is now the new congressman in the 7th Congressional District, which was made more Republican in the 2010-2011 redistricting. And in that redistricting, they added New Kent County, a very Republican eastern suburb of Richmond, and New Kent County was part of the reason that the new voters in that district were part of the reason that Eric Cantor went down in the primary. They'd never voted for him before, and he wasn't quite conservative enough for them.
434-979-0919, if you have a question or a comment for our guest today, Bob Gibson, the executive director at the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership here in the Charlottesville, Albemarle County area. Bob, you mentioned to me something, and I don't know if this is your phrase or mine, self-segregation, self-redistricting, when you were talking about how Afton Mountain seems to split a strong Republican group in Augusta and Rockingham County versus a strong Democratic group in the Charlottesville-Albemarle County area.
Well, there are different settlement patterns to the different sides of the Blue Ridge Mountains that go back for centuries. And the valley is now much, much, much more Republican than the Piedmont in this area. Charlottesville and Albemarle and Nelson County, for example, gave majorities to Mark Warner on Tuesday, whereas Ed Gillespie, the Republican challenger, who ran a very close race, won huge margin, 71% in Augusta County, 73% in Rockingham County. So it's just a very different settlement pattern that leads to a different sort of cultural norm. Even Stanton, which is sort of a little Charlottesville in the middle of the Shenandoah Valley, went by a small number, I guess double digits, for Ed Gillespie over Mark Warner. Harrisonburg did go for Warner. Harrisonburg is slightly larger and slightly more Democratic city, but Rockingham County surrounding Harrisonburg was overwhelmingly Republican, and the map shows red in rural Virginia from Charlottesville south and west. I mean, basically we have the Democratic Party in Virginia and in the country at large has a rural problem. They are not winning elections in rural areas.
Let's talk for a minute about some of the specific issues to a state versus what happened nationally with their leadership votes. I touched on a few of these to start, but I have five of them down here. Marijuana legalization voted for and approved in Oregon, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. The state of Florida had a 57%.
But they needed 60 to pass, so it didn't pass.
But more than half approved marijuana legalization. It just didn't meet their minimum standard.
Right.
Alaska, Arkansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, Illinois, plus individual cities in California and Wisconsin voted to increase minimum wage. State of Washington voted to require background checks for the sale of firearms in any way, whether it's through a business or solo private purchases. State of Illinois voted to require prescription birth control be covered by health insurance.
They were electing a Republican governor. And all of these states, and many of these states, Republicans were winning elections, and yet these issues that are more associated with the more progressive side of the ledger are winning at the same time, which shows you how much of a disconnect there was between Democrats and what their issues are.
Right, and that's something that I don't, that I'm having trouble sort of feeding both in and then out of my brain. The personhood issue, the abortion, where personhood is considered to be a living life at the moment
of conception.
And so therefore abortion of any set would be murder. And so
And certain types of birth control would be ruled out as well. So that went down heavily for the third time in Colorado.
Third time in Colorado, whose incumbent senator, I believe, made that his big issue about women's rights. And yet he lost his race to his Republican contender. But one of his issues about women's rights and how this would fall into that voted in more of a Democratic/liberal manner.
Well, Democrats may have overplayed their hand on some of these issues over time. White male Americans voted overwhelmingly, just overwhelmingly, for Republican candidates in the midterm elections on Tuesday, 64% to 34%. White males voted Republican over Democratic candidates. Women did vote predominantly for Democrats, but not as strongly as the Democrats needed and not as strongly as in the past. So perhaps that issue didn't have the salience that it once did.
Do you think that wherever the United States may have stood on racial issues in electing an African-American president 6 years ago has been washed away, and so now it's WNRN, that black guy isn't doing the job, so I don't want a black guy as president anymore?
Well, the president has a number of problems, which may include his race, but they include his performance in office, his ability to compromise, his ability to lead. Some of his positions are unpopular, so I wouldn't blame it all on race. I think Doug Wilder was elected governor of Virginia 25 years ago this month. We're on the 25th anniversary of that. In fact, it would have been on the cover of Time magazine if the Berlin Wall hadn't fallen at the same time, and the Berlin Wall falling became the Time cover instead of Governor Doug Wilder being elected in Virginia. We've made progress on race, but it's not always a linear thing in the same direction. I mean, it's sort of a two steps forward, one step back kind of thing, and that's the way politics works in this country on many issues.
I feel obligated to talk about that, because when we do give out numbers such as 64% of white males voted Republican, a lot of times the Republican Party is viewed as wealthy business owners who want to be in power. And now if you want to look at specific issues, that breaks down a lot, because you can get to you can get into evangelical and all sorts of other topics.
Well, there was a tremendous advantage for the Republicans in the midterm. The midterm electorate is very different from the presidential electorate to start with. It's 2 to 3% more Republican traditionally every midterm. And of course, there were other factors that accentuated that and made it even stronger and more Republican than the normal presidential electorate, which is much, much larger. Men who are without a college degree voted overwhelmingly Republican. So you can't just say it's the corporations. It's men in general who are voting Republican, whether they have a college degree or not. Certainly if they don't, it's a tremendous proportion for the Republican candidate. And those aren't wealthy individuals, by and large. Those are working class, middle class folks who are voting Republican, because the Republican Party has appealed to them more on certain issues than the Democratic Party has. The Democratic Party has got to get its act together if it's going to come back and be as competitive as it would like to be.
Now, typically, only about a third of the Senate seats are up for election every 2 years. So we'll have another third of Senate seats available in 2 years from now.
And correct? A very different electorate. It'll be a much larger electorate. The millennials didn't vote this time. The youngest part of the electorate did not turn out to vote. They will in a presidential election. That's a pattern that holds true every 2 and 4 years. The electorate that votes in the midterms is older and more conservative and more white. Latinos stayed away in larger numbers than 2 years ago. Black voters stayed away in larger numbers than 2 years ago. It's always a different electorate. And it will be a very different electorate in 2016. And the party that will be defending the most senators will be the Republicans this time, and they will be defending a lot of senators in blue states, whereas the Democrats were defending a lot of incumbents who lost in red states this time.
38 minutes after the hour, Bob Gibson here from the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Bob, that brought up a question flitted across my brain. There were all these comments about disenfranchisement with the new voter registration and showing your ID to vote, et cetera. Has there been any word about that as to whether it was who suffered from that, if anyone?
Well, it's hard to tell who didn't vote and why. Exit polls generally tell you who did vote and why. And it does not appear that there was any great problem with voter ID in Virginia this year among those who did vote. People, if they did not have an ID with them, were eligible to vote a provisional ballot and then to produce some sort of ID by Friday of last week, by 2 days ago, to have their vote counted. And the largest locality in the state, Fairfax County, had 500-some provisional ballots cast on Tuesday. I don't know how many of those were actually finally counted, but they could have been if folks had gone and gotten the right ID. If it was an ID provisional ballot, there are other reasons that provisional ballots are cast.
But we don't know. I mean, I saw, when I went to vote, I saw one woman who was obviously having trouble. I'm standing in line, and she's up front, and she's working with those, working the books, whatever the proper phrase is for that employee or that volunteer for the state. And then at some point, someone comes in and takes her away, and the snippet of the conversation I hear is, let's go find out why you're not in our records.
Well, there are various problems that voters had and non-voters may have had. We don't know why people stayed away from the polls. Many people may have stayed away from the polls for different reasons. But there are provisional ballots cast by voters who don't have the proper ID in hand. There are provisional ballots cast by people who just show up at the wrong polling place. There are provisional ballots cast by people who aren't on the list when they should be, or just aren't on the right list, haven't registered when they thought they did. Many of those people, if they registered at the DMV through a federal motor voter law, the local electoral board will decide that, you know, they can cast a provisional ballot, and they will count their ballot. But many provisional ballots are just people showing up at the wrong place.
Yeah, I mean, right here in Albemarle, there's two schools, one in front of the other, both of which are polling places, and it's quite easy to go to the wrong one.
And gerrymandering is a process, to get back to the theme that we started the show with. Gerrymandering is a process that confuses voters because they don't know the lines. The lines don't make sense to them. They're not drawn for a community and a compactness, a compact size, and a community of interest. They're drawn for a partisan advantage. So they hop and skip all over the place and don't give the voter a solid idea of what district they may be in.
I don't know what all of them are now, but a decade ago, I guess before the more recent redistricting, Creed Deeds, his district was often made fun of because it looked like a dumbbell. It was a big circle, I guess, around the Charlottesville-Albemarle area.
Well, it was sort of a butterfly district. It had a wing on this side of the Blue Ridge that stretched out to the eastern edge of Albemarle County, and it had a wing on the western side of the Blue Ridge that stretched out to the West Virginia line in Bath County, where Creed Deeds is from, and there was almost nothing in the middle at the Blue Ridge.
Right. So if you get in your car and drive from Charlottesville to Bath County, that's quite a drive.
Well, you can't do it inside Creed Deeds' district. You have to leave the district to get from one end to the other.
He was supposed to be the representative for those living in Charlottesville.
But that district was drawn for Emily Couric. That district was a tailings district between two strong Republican districts that were drawn to its north and to its south. And the Democrats in the middle were left over into Emily Couric's district.
And then currently Robert Hurt has an unusual district that runs from Danville up Route 29 into Charlottesville.
Oh, it runs far north of Charlottesville. It runs north of Interstate 66 in Fauquier County. So it's the U.S. 29 district, all right. It goes all the way from the North Carolina line at Danville all the way up north of Warrenton into Fauquier County and to just north of Interstate 66. So it's a district that makes no sense in terms of compactness or communities of interest, but makes a great deal of sense in terms of protecting a Republican incumbent.
I've lost track of time. 43 minutes after the hour. Be right back with Bob Gibson.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
L. Oppelman, serving Lynchburg for 122 years. In addition to loans, L. Oppelman deals in jewelry, musical instruments, rifles and handguns, game systems, TVs, cameras and tools, with new inventory arriving every day. L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street, downtown Lynchburg.
Sedona Tap House, serious food and over 500 craft beers at 1035 Millmont Street, Charlottesville, behind Barracks Road Shopping Center. Sedona Tap House hosts Seafood Sunday with fresh, hand-cut, wood-grilled fish on special, plus a craft beer seminar and tasting at 1 p.m. 434-296-BEER or SedonaTapHouse.com. You can also find Sedona Tap House in Westchester Commons, Midlothian.
Hello, I'm Kipton Davis from Startup Weekend up Charlottesville. Our mission is to develop a world in which everyone can experience and pursue entrepreneurship. On the weekend of November 14th, you have an opportunity to transform your education ideas into action in 54 hours. There will be a Charlottesville Startup Education Weekend and Hardware Hackathon to find the right people with complementary skills and to build an education product. You can design for learning, conduct user tests, receive coaching from experienced entrepreneurs, engineers, education designers, and industry professionals that will help take your idea to the next level. For more information, up.com/communities/USA/Charlottesville. I'm Kipton Davis, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being with us this morning as we talk about some of the issues, the things that we learned, the oddities from the most recent election. Bob Gibson is our guest today from the Sorenson Institute of Political Leadership. So, Bob, as far as the Virginia elections went, we know that Mark Warner had a surprisingly close re-election campaign with Ed Gillespie.
Right, 7 points closer than the poll average leading into the election. So it surprised an awful lot of people, including Mark Warner and Ed Gillespie.
When you see that sort of thing happen, so Mark Warner barely wins. In fact, he doesn't even get 50%. Does that tell him that when he goes back to work that he needs to change what he's been doing? Or that, I won, so that means that I can keep, you know, promoting the same thoughts and processes that I've been going for?
Well, it tells him that he's representing the entire electorate in Virginia, and that the Democratic Party, which nominates him, has problems in rural areas of Virginia, rural areas where he used to run very strongly in Southwest Virginia and Southside. He did not run very strongly on Tuesday. So I think Mark Warner, who tends to be one of the last certified centrists, who was not campaigning out in the base of his party, but was campaigning with John Warner and talking about his ability to work across the aisle and to compromise and to be a centrist, has a lot of work to do with the base of his party. And perhaps, you know, Tim Kaine, who runs more as a Democrat with the base of his party, has leapfrogged ahead of Mark Warner, some people would say, in terms of being considered as possibly a vice presidential nominee in 16. It looks like Tim Kaine now is the pick, if the Democrats are to pick a Virginian as a running mate, and not Mark Warner. But that's speculation, and that's the kind of speculation that pundits engage in, and I'm not a pundit. So,
and when I came home from work after voting on Tuesday, I had two auto robot phone calls from Mark Warner and one from Tim Kaine. Also, you know, everyone's saying, hey, if you haven't voted yet, please go out to vote. I don't know if that's because they think that I'm a Democrat or because they had more money than Ed Gillespie to do that sort of last minute.
Well, Ed Gillespie has a gripe, and it's a legitimate gripe. A lot of Republican groups and funders withheld money from him toward the end of his campaign based on polls. And the polls showed an insurmountable lead by Mark Warner in the weeks before the election. And that kind of dried up the money. The same thing happened to Ken Cuccinelli a year earlier. The polls showed a much more large margin for Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate for governor, than they did for Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican candidate for governor, who narrowed it to 2-some percent at the end, whereas Ed Gillespie went from, you know, an average of 8-point-something percent in the polls down to just losing by 0.8%. So Ed Gillespie has a legitimate gripe that money didn't come his way because people believe polls.
Now, you mentioned that Tim Kaine may be a more, I don't know if acceptable is the right word, but more likely to be thought of as a prominent vice presidential candidate.
Perhaps more in tune with his party's base.
But Virginia is now...
Virginia is
has lost a lot of power on the, you know, national hierarchy.
Well, we've lost power because three of our senior members of the House of Representatives are no longer there. Frank Wolf is retiring in the 10th District, where he's being replaced by Republican Representative-elect Barbara Comstock, a delegate from McLean. Don Beyer is replacing longtime Democratic Representative Jim Moran of the 8th District in inner, you know, Fairfax. And
but he had he also had a powerful role on a committee. What was his?
Well, he did. He was there for a long time.
Didn't he have? Wasn't he on a financial committee, like doling out
No, money? But he had a lot to do with federal contracts.
Okay.
And then the surprise this year, of course, because it wasn't through a voluntary retirement, was Eric Cantor being replaced by Dave Bratt. So there was no change in party representation, but about 70 or 80 years or more of seniority went out the window on November 4th.
And then both of our senators are now in the minority party.
They're both in the minority party, and they're both relatively young first term. Mark Warner just entering his second term in January, whereas, you know, they're both former governors, so they're, and you know, they have other things going for them. It doesn't really matter as much in the Senate which party you're in, because the Senate has, senators have certain powers that representatives don't have. If you're a backbencher in the minority party in the House, you can be a very lonely guy in terms of power. But senators have a little bit more.
A backbencher. Does that mean you can't get a new seat until one of the ones in front of you opens up? Somebody has to get up and leave the room before you can move forward.
It means you're not in one of the seats of power near the front of the room. You're sort of a backbench supporter of your party. And there are plenty of those. There are a lot of folks who do, and there are a lot of folks who don't distinguish themselves in Washington.
11:51 here talking with Bob Gibson. So we talk about Tim Kaine or even Mark Warner being considered a vice presidential candidate in 2016 or 2020. Virginia is, or let me rephrase that, is Virginia still a powerful state on the national scale?
Yes.
With these five changes?
And the answer is not because of the individuals who sit in the congressional chairs in the House and the Senate. The answer is because Virginia is right on the cutting edge where the nation is in terms of our political divide. We are closer to the national divide of Democrats and Republicans than any other state. So, with the possible exception of Ohio, Virginia and Ohio are the two closest states to mirroring the nation's divide, which is very, very significant. It means that Virginia and Ohio will see more campaign commercials in the presidential election, whether you like them or
Yeehaw.
Not. Yeah, whether you like them or not, we're going to be targets.
So it sounds like what I'm hearing is that Virginia as a state, in terms of what gets done, maybe not, but the 13 electoral votes mean, yes, we're quite powerful.
They do. We are. We're also a relatively rich state, so people come here for money. We're a state on a partisan knife's edge in terms of our purple status. In a statewide election, we can go either way, even though all the House districts are gerrymandered to represent one party or the other, largely. Virginia is right there on the knife's edge and can go either way in a statewide election.
Again, Bob Gibson here with us today. Let me take a moment and remind everybody that WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, we're looking for a producer to help with the show. We're looking for someone to split. So do two Sundays every month. Have an interest in the program, you're available to volunteer two Sundays every month, and you have a basic ability with computers, we can teach you the rest. Email us at volunteers@wnrn.org or stop by the station during normal Monday through Friday working hours. So, Bob, just about 6 minutes left. You talk about Virginia being on... and Ohio being representative of where things are now nationally. Virginia demographics?
Yes.
Changing in what
yes.
way?
Well, Virginia's demographics have changed significantly. For the first time in the 2010 census, a majority of Virginians were born outside the Commonwealth, outside the state of Virginia. 4 in 10 Virginians were born in other states.
That's a lot of move-ins.
It is. It means we have jobs. It means we have economic opportunity. It means that people are moving because of their idea that they can better themselves and their families through economic opportunity in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We're a low-tax state, relatively. We are geographically well-situated right on the Atlantic within a tremendous ability to be close to major markets in the East. We have the best port in the nation, and we have an opportunity that has attracted many people. 1 in every 9 Virginians was born in a foreign country. That's amazing. 44% of those Virginia residents born in a foreign country were born in an Asian nation. India and Korea and the Philippines and Vietnam, for four examples, have a tremendous number of Virginians were born in those Asian nations. So we have a lot of folks moving into the Commonwealth, and that has changed our demographics. It's changed our politics because the 4 in 10 Virginians born in other states were mostly born in states to our north and moved in from states to our north. They brought the Republican politics, if they're Republicans, and the Democratic politics, if they're Democrats, in with them from the state from which they moved, which sort of changes the Democratic and Republican nature of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
So we were talking about Mark Warner, and in fact, this has been a comment about Democrats nationally, which is not promoting what they feel were positive economic results for the last 6 years. So, and then I look back to Virginia's governors, how both Governor McDonnell and Governor McAuliffe traveled and have come back to announce large new corporations or significant job openings because of their work in bringing industry back to the state of Virginia. But you don't hear that from a senator, or I didn't hear that from Mark Warner in the state of Virginia. Is that because that's not the role of a senator?
Pretty much.
Because that
falls
into that same
senator group? Doesn't have the same opportunity to bring jobs in that a now he or she may have the opportunity to vote on issues that relate to the economy, but it's difficult to bring someone into a state unless you are the governor, and governors of both parties have done that successfully and have to do that because Virginia's workforce is changing. We have to become less reliant on federal contracts and more reliant on small business.
So do you think that'll change and that senators such as Warner and Tim Kaine will start to do that sort of work? Or is it that standard of you go legislate for a few hours and then you go drum up reelection funds for the rest of your day?
Well, a senator's role is very different from a governor's role, and governors have the ability to travel the world and sign contracts and bring firms in and cut deals for those firms to consider Virginia a new home. Although the amount of money isn't very large, they just brought a major brewery into Richmond. So that sort of thing goes on. It's more governors who have the effect in that arena than it is senators. Senators are both advantaged and disadvantaged by having to be in Washington and take votes on controversial matters. So all of them, after a certain period of time, can become more and more unpopular. But they also have incumbency, which offers them more money and other advantages. So governors who become senators experience a high degree of frustration.
Just a minute left with Bob Gibson. So real quick on third-party candidates, because we talk about how Mark Warner won the race. He didn't even get 50%. Do you think that Mr. Sarvis, the Libertarian, what did he end up with, 2.5%?
Yeah, 53,000-some votes. He may have made a difference. He may not. You know, you don't know if the 17,000 or so vote margin that Mark Warner ended up with over Ed Gillespie would have come would have been vastly different had Sarvis not been in the race. It's difficult to tell what Sarvis voters would have done. Some of them would have voted for Warner. Some of them wouldn't have voted. Some of them would have voted for Gillespie.
But what about other states? Were there any other states on the national level where third-party candidates probably played a role?
There may have been, but the two parties have the elections so stacked in their favor that it's very, very difficult for a third-party candidate or an independent to make much of a difference.
All right, Bob Gibson, Executive Director at the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership. Bob, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Rick.
I always love talking about something that's more than just the numbers and talking about gerrymandering and the difference on things like marijuana legislation and minimum wage increase not really matching up to some of the leaders that were elected. I'm fascinated by
that. Well, we've got to restore trust and civility and respect in our politics, and that's a major thing we're trying to do at the Sorenson Institute.
Well, best of luck with that. I'll give you a thumbs up and follow you along.
Thanks.
Next week, we will have students from the Renaissance School, award winners in synthetic biology, will be here to talk about that. Hope to see you next week. Les Timms-Perdue up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong and Maxicilia Struther. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.